Our next presenter, he's the executive director for the Foundation Beyond Belief, and he's the author of the recent Atheism for Dummies. Please get it for Dan McGowan.
Wait, hi everybody. I had a great experience in the last year and a half or so of working on two books back to back about atheism. One of them was Voices of Unbelief, Documents from Atheists and Agnostics. This was it's an anthology, a hardcover, large format reference book primarily for schools and libraries. It's aimed at high school and early college readers, and 45 documents by atheists and agnostics through history. And then the other one that right on its heels was Atheism for Dummies, which just released last week. The official release date is tomorrow, but it's out. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about some of the things that I learned while writing these books. Now, one of the things I have to say about the Dummies series, one of the things they're very, very clear about with the publisher is that the readers are not assumed to be dummies in general. They are assumed to be intelligent people who simply don't know much about a particular issue and want to learn about it. So that's a good thing, because that gave me the liberty to actually write for intelligent people instead of, you know, really trying to do something else. So the dummies thing in my title as well is, I wasn't really talking to dummies in this, but one of the things I did along the way is learned a tremendous amount about atheism that I didn't know. And that's what I want to give to you. So one of the things that I say in the introduction to the book is that this is primarily written for a lay audience, people who are not as familiar with it. But those of you who are more familiar with atheism, if you're willing to read over these people's shoulders a little bit for most of the book, I will occasionally fire a t-shirt cannon up into the cheap seats for you. That's what this talk is. I'm basically 20 t-shirts for you is what this amounts to. So the book, the things I'm not going to talk about today are the sort of standard things that are in the book that everybody needs to know about atheism. They need to know about the Four Horsemen. They need to know about the reasons that most atheists are atheists. I'm sorry, did you miss those? There it is. The various terminology that we use and what it means and what it doesn't mean and whether it means anything and that. The context of science and what that does to the atheist viewpoint. Pascal's wager, I talk about Madeline Murray O'Hare, our various documents and our organizations and our symbols and kind of these eternal questions like, was Hitler an atheist? You know, that sort of thing has to be addressed at some point. So that's not what I'm going to be talking about today. I'm talking about other things that might be of more interest to you, things that were certainly of interest to me. So the first one on the list, I learned that there wasn't already an Atheism for Dummies. I couldn't believe it. This book didn't exist yet. 1,600 books in the Dummies series, and that one hadn't been written yet. There was, you know, there's Philosophy for Dummies, there's, you know, Gardening for Dummies, Digital Photography for Dummies, Religion for Dummies, which was is actually a really good book. Mormonism for Dummies, Catholicism for Dummies. There are lots of denominational titles. The Bible for Dummies. There is a Lost Books of the Bible for Dummies. The Book of Revelation. So there are specific dummies books for specific books of the Bible, but not atheism until now. Farmville for Dummies came out first before the worldview of a billion people on Earth, Farmville, which is probably the worldview of 1.2 billion people on Earth, I don't know. Logic for Dummies came out 2 years ago, I like that one. But my favorite example of one that apparently had to be written before Atheism for Dummies is called eBay for Canadians for Dummies. Come on. Okay, number 19. Some people think there's only one thing to say. This has been the oddest reaction that I got from people when I said that I was writing this book. This sort of snarky reaction from atheists and believers alike who said, oh, that'll be the skinniest book on the shelf. It just has to say, atheists are people who don't believe in God. Well, that's a definition, for crying out loud. That's what you would get in a dictionary. I dare say there's more to say about atheism than that. It's as if I said I was going to write a book about the Grand Canyon, and I say, the Grand Canyon is a big hole in Arizona. Give me my royalties, okay? So that was an odd thing. This morning on my Facebook page, again, a Facebook friend of mine said the same thing. He said, how do you simplify something as simple as rejecting God? I mean, you just say, no, I don't believe in that, as if that's all there is to say. 18, there is no atheist Vatican. Now, I suspected that for years, but it turns out that that made my task very different from the task of the guys who wrote Catholicism for Dummies, for example, because it turns out there is a Catholic Vatican, and one of the things that they had to do, not only that they were able to do, but that they were required to do, is to get the sign-off of the Vatican hierarchy on their book. So on the title page of their book, there is the Nihil Obstat,
yeah,
which is a which translates to nothing stands in the way. Okay, so a the censor librorum of the hierarchy had to go through the text and be sure that it contained no doctrinal or moral errors. Now, writing an entire book on Catholicism without any moral errors is a trick, but they apparently did it. And then it gets the imprimatur of somebody else, of an archbishop who said, you know, okay, it's all right to go to print. Now, I don't want that stuff in a way. I don't want somebody telling me what the atheist line is. But in another way, I was quite concerned as I'm writing it. I wanted to be accurate. You know, I wanted to get things right, even if there wasn't a standard party line. So I got Ed Buckner, a really, really good guy, really one of the great minds, I think, in free thought in the United States, former president of American Atheists. He served as my technical editor, went through everything, improved the entire text, made sure that I wasn't making enormous errors. And so if any errors did sneak through, it's actually the fault of the Atheist Vatican. Okay. Number 17, I learned that finding non-believers in history is like finding a mouse in church. You just follow the shrieking. Now, this is one of the things that's difficult is I want to go into the 8th century, for example, and find atheist voices. That's very difficult because they tended to be obliterated. The writings tended to be destroyed, whatever there were, or not made in the first place because it wasn't a very good idea. So I thought, how am I going to find what these people have? I know they're there, right? Just like I know the mouse is in the church, but I don't actually have to see the mouse. I just have to see all the people going, ah, an atheist. So that's what I looked for in a lot of the history. An example is the half dozen most important atheists in the ancient world would be entirely unknown to us if it weren't for people like Cicero and Sextus Empiricus, who wrote about them disapprovingly, who called them wicked scribblers, I think was Cicero's term, talking about some of these really important people and quoting from their works. Now, Cicero was doing it with a wink, because Cicero, if anybody was a skeptic in this period, it was him. But he was saying what he needed to say, and as a result, he helped to preserve some of these works that would otherwise be gone. My favorite example is Celsus, who in the second century wrote the first comprehensive attack on Christianity. It was an entire book that went after Christianity root and branch. And the Catholic father, Origen, was so upset about this book that he recopied the entire book into his own work and refuted it line by line, and then burned all of Celsus's manuscripts, right? But he had just recopied the whole thing into his book. So all we had to do is take Origen out, collapse it, and you've got the original book, the whole thing, every word of Celsus's original book. So helpful shrieking. And then Islamic clerics in the Islamic Golden Age, so-called, I'll talk about that in a minute, unbelievers, including former theologians, were so common in this period. They were called zendikes, and they were so common in this period that an entire genre of theological writing developed called Against the Unbelievers. Every theologian in this period had something against the unbelievers, and in the process of doing it, they first of all show us that unbelievers were present, and secondly, quote their works extensively so that they helped to preserve that. Thank you. Number 16, India and China are great places to look for atheism, and there's a lot less shrieking, because these two cultures have been much more amenable to the atheist voice from the beginning, going way back, you know, two or three millennia back. An example, 9th century Jain teacher. Jainism is a, first of all, my favorite religion on earth. If you're going to pick a religion, that's the one. It is a non-theistic, non-violent religion. And a Jain teacher in the 9th century said, "Some foolish men declare the Creator made the world. The doctrine that the world was created is ill-advised and should be rejected. If God created the world, where was he before creation? How can an immaterial God create that which is material? Who will believe this silly stuff?" I love that. "If he created out of love for living things, why did he not make creation wholly blissful and free from misfortune? Thus, the doctrine that the world was created by God makes no sense at all." This is the stuff I said in high school, you know? This is exactly the stuff I said in high school, and that you probably did. And then to hear a 9th century thinker in the middle of a very religious culture saying this, not only saying it, but the words were preserved. It was valued, it was part of the culture, part of the conversation among these various worldviews, and it was passed on from generation to generation. We didn't have to sort of find it from the screaming. China, same thing. They, non-theistic voices were present and active from the beginning in Chinese philosophy. It's an interesting thing that confuses that issue a little in China. They're always talking about Tian. This is one of the words that comes up all the time, Tian, which is translated as heaven. And that confuses matters because that's not what it means. The better translation is that which causes things to be as they are. So if you are a theistic philosopher in China, Tian means the gods. If you are a non-theistic, for example, a Confucian philosopher in China in the ancient world, Tian means natural processes, natural forces. Here's a 4th century BCE, Shunzi is the philosopher. He said, "Pray all you want, heaven can't hear you. It's not going to stop the winter because you are cold, and it's not going to make the earth smaller because you don't want to walk so far." I love that one. "You pray for rain and it rains, but your prayer has nothing to do with it. Sometimes you don't pray for rain and it rains anyway. What do you say then?" Again, it's me in high school, right? But it's not. It's this 4th century BCE Chinese non-theistic philosopher. Okay, number 15, the 1,000-year silence isn't so silent, if you know where to look. Now, you probably know what I mean by the 1,000-year silence. You get to the end of Rome, right? And then there's this 1,000-year gap when atheists seem to vanish, and then they reappear in the Renaissance, right? Well, they were there the whole time, and one of the delights of this project was finding them. Most anthologies simply go over that, but I tried to find places that where they were present and accounted for. The Jains in India is an example. The Zendikes in the Islamic Golden Age, 8th, 9th, 10th century. Neo-Confucians in 11th century China. I found Inquisition transcripts in 14th century France. I actually got to the point with Voices of Unbelief where I was so thrilled with how much of the gap I had filled in. And then I got a note from the publisher that said, "You know, we're looking over the documents and we noticed that there are 2 centuries you haven't accounted for yet. Could you do that?" They had no idea that this was a big deal to have filled in 8 of those blanks. So I said, "No, I can't." Number 14, I learned that some people have a lot of nerve. One of them was Diagoras of Melos. This very cheeky atheist in ancient Greece who Cicero was the one who told us about him. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. For example, he was a well-known atheist. He was horrified people wherever he went. He was on a ship at sea that went into a storm, and the sailors were shrieking that it's because he's on board. It's because they brought a non-believer on board, and now our ship is going to be sunk. And so Diagoras said, "So I guess all those other ships out there have a Diagoras on board as well." That's the kind of, again, at my smart alecky best in high school, that's the sort of thing I would have come up with. He, one time in front of a bunch of onlookers, he chopped up a wooden statue of Hercules and put it into his cooking fire. And everybody, you know, was horrified. And he said, "Cooking my turnips will be his 13th labor." So he was imprisoned and he was bailed out and he was imprisoned again. He had a lot of nerve. Al-Rawandi, an Islamic scholar in the Golden Age, called Muhammad a liar. And he said that the Quran is the speech of an unwise being. And then Abu Nuwas, also in the Persian Golden Age, a poet, the Islamic Golden Age, was in the mosque one day, and at one point the imam is reading from a hadith, and he gets to the line, "Oh, you non-believers," or no, "Oh, you infidels," is what it was. And he says, "Here I am." And the crowd descends on him and drags him to the magistrates. Well, what they assume is that he was a Manichaeist. That's what they assumed, the rival religion that followed the prophet Mani. And so they're going to ferret this out. They bring a portrait of Mani before him, and they say, "Spit on the portrait of Mani." And he says, "I'll do you one better," and he sticks his finger down his throat and vomits on the portrait. And the confused magistrates let him go. Because it never occurred to them that he might actually think that Mani and Muhammad were both full of it, right? Number 13, the flying nuns. Okay. The stats. The stats drove me crazy in this project because they're changing so fast. It was very difficult. I only had 4 months to write this whole thing. Very, very collapsed timeline. And even in the course of that, partly because the Pew study came out in the middle of the writing process, I had to go back and change all of my stats. But at the moment, nuns are a fifth of U.S. adults, but in terms of actual beliefs and behaviors, it's a fourth. And a third of the millennials 18 to 29, as Jesse pointed out earlier. This is interesting. 59% of the nuns are best classified as agnostics or deists. Okay, so most of them are in a different category probably from most of the people in this room. And 24% of current nuns and 35% of first generation nuns are former Catholics. That is our farm team, right? So, and this is actually, I worked at a Catholic college and for a long time, and that's one of the reasons that Catholic institutions are very, very nervous about having the free thought voice there, because they're losing their youngest generation. Oh well. Number 12 is the Congress has non-believers in the plural, right? We were all very pleased to have Pete Stark there representing us for so many years. We're very sorry to see him lose his seat in last year's election. Again, while I was writing, I had to keep going back and changing things. But I learned that the Secular Coalition for America did a silent poll of Congress and determined that there are actually 28 in Congress who admitted in that poll that they do not believe in a higher being. So we're actually looking at an awful lot of Pete Starks, more than we actually typically think. Number 11 is that Iceland has an 800-year-old beautiful loss of faith story. This was a real surprise to me when I discovered this. The saga of Hrafnkell. Hrafnkell is a warrior chief in Ireland who worships Freyr. Freyr is the god of wealth and sunshine and sex. That's nice work if you can get it. And so he worships him for some reason, and he builds a big temple to him. And despite doing this and burning offerings to him all the time, he is attacked by an enemy. He and his people are enslaved. And so what does Hrafnkell say? Does he say, "Oh, Freyr works in mysterious ways"? No, he doesn't. He says, "I was an idiot to believe in gods. They don't exist." So what happens is he eventually escapes from slavery, spares the life of his captor, and goes and lives in peace and contentment without belief in gods, and dies in his bed. Now, you're expecting the whole time you're reading the saga for him to have some epiphany and turn back like they usually do in these stories, but no. Here in the folklore of Iceland, their national founding sagas, there is the story of this non-believer who only becomes truly happy once he gets rid of the gods. Okay, the unchurched belt was an interesting discovery. You know the Bible Belt. Everybody knows the Bible Belt, which never really has looked like a belt. It's more of a prostate inflammation in this picture. But there's also, in 1985, there was an identification of a secular belt, or an unchurched belt is what they called it. It actually was the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California. All had 25% roughly unchurched people who, in professed belief and in behavior, were non-religious. That changed in the time since, because California, with the influx of Catholic Hispanics, has fallen off the secular bandwagon. But now the eight states that compromise the unchurched belt are these. Wyoming really surprised me. I thought that was surprising. So it's not really a belt of any kind at this point. It's more of a like an earring and like a 1980s mobile phone and a hair ribbon and a square eye patch of the unchurched. But that's the way things are sorting out now. Those are all places where it's 24% or more unchurched. The leading state at the moment is Vermont, which I actually hadn't realized. Rapidly gained 34% unchurched in Vermont. What's that?
The senator from there, Bernie.
Bernie Sanders. Yeah.
I mean, what do you expect?
Exactly. Right. Well, I always expect them to be independent, and I knew they'd be up there. I just didn't think they'd actually beaten the Northwest. Northwest was always winning. Okay, the kids are all right. That's another thing I discovered. All these things about the millennials that are so heartening in these trends. 32% non-religious. This is a nice error to find in the book because once the Pew study came out, I had to go through and revise all of my stats, and I missed one place where I talked about the millennials. So in one chapter, it says they're 22% non-religious, and another one, it says they're 32%. So I'll hear about that from somebody. Only 54% believe in a personal God. 18% have already, at this age, left the family faith. Now, that's a very interesting thing because that number is 7% for, I think, greatest generation. It's actually 7%. And they've had a longer time to leave it, you know, who have ever left the family faith. And one of the other interesting things is when this cohort, when the millennials are asked about Christianity, what do you think about Christianity? Most of them include strong negatives. And this is not just the non-religious ones, but across the board. 58% said hypocritical is one of the first words that comes to mind. 62% said judgmental. And 64% said anti-gay is one of the first things that occurs. Now, this is across the board, not just the secular millennials. So that was interesting. Next, I love Darwin's granddaughter. How many people know Nora Barlow by name? Is that a widely known? Oh, awesome! You see, my book is gonna be helpful in some ways because she's really cool. Nora Barlow was Darwin's granddaughter, and she just died in the late 80s, I think it was, or something like that, at 104 years old or something. But she was a botanist, and one of the things that you may or may not know about Darwin's autobiography is that before it was published, 5 years after his death, his wife asked for everything to be stripped out that indicated that he was a doubter, a religious doubter. So she, the family actually almost came to blows, lawsuit within the family about the publication. Francis, his son, who was the editor of it, wanted to keep it in. And she insisted, he finally did what she wanted, some of the others, I mean, it was a mess. But 20 passages were stripped out. Here's an example. I liked the thought of being a country clergyman. I did not then in the least doubt the strict and literal truth of every word in the Bible, and soon persuaded myself that our creed must be fully accepted. Now, that was not stripped out. That was kept in. But Nora Barlow, his granddaughter, in 1958, got her hands on the original manuscript of his autobiography, and she published an unexpurgated autobiography of Darwin, restoring all of these passages and noting which ones had been removed. So now, with her new edition, here's the way it reads. I liked the thought of being a country clergyman. I did not then in the least doubt the strict and literal truth of every word in the Bible, and soon persuaded myself that our creed must be fully accepted. It never struck me how illogical it was to say that I believed in what I could not understand and what is, in fact, unintelligible. Changes the meaning a bit. This is one of my favorites, the Clandestina. In the 17th century, a number of documents began circulating anonymously around Europe that were the first explicitly atheistic documents in Europe since the ancient world. And they were collectively called the Clandestina. They were these secret things. They got passed around from hand to hand. They were not in the bookstores. This is a very shocking thing. The first one was called Theophrastus Redivivus. They had learned from the Catholic Church that if you put something in Latin, it sounds really cool. And another one was Symbolum Sapientiae was the second one. But these are things that really went after belief in a very straightforward way, no mincing words. And they got secretly passed around. My favorite one was called a book called The Treatise of the Three Impostors. Now, the reason that I love this book is that it started as a rumor. As early as the 12th century, there was a rumor in Europe that there was this book that calls Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad imposters and liars, and that it makes these arguments against religious faith and religious belief. And everybody just would talk about this book. Did you hear about the three imposters and all this? But nobody ever seemed to have it, because it almost certainly didn't exist. It was entirely a legend. But then suddenly, in the early 1700s, early 18th century, it starts appearing all over the place, the three imposters. And one of the people who had it was John Toland, who was a free thinker and poet and satirist in Ireland. And he said, oh, look what I found from a friend of a friend of a friend. And all of a sudden, the three imposters was spreading around Europe, and it's a really devastating set of arguments against all three Abrahamic faiths. And Toland almost certainly wrote it, right? He took the myth, he took the legendary book, and he made it real and printed it and disseminated it. And it was illegal in virtually every European country during this period of time. So, but it's considered to have been one of the foundations of Enlightenment thought, especially the anti-religious, the religious critique of the Enlightenment, Clandestina. Number six, I learned that Percy Shelley got kicked out of Oxford for being an atheist out loud. I didn't actually know that. 19 years old, he wrote a tract called On the Necessity of Atheism, and just signed it An Atheist, right? Didn't sign his name, but he sort of scattered it around the grounds of Oxford and, you know, went off and did his homework. And everybody picked it up, read this shocking thing, and said, Shelley. that's totally Shelley. And so he gets dragged before the deans of Oxford, because blasphemy is illegal in England at this point. This is a big deal. And his father's in Parliament. He gets dragged before the deans and is asked to whether he did this, and he wouldn't confirm or deny it. And so he got booted out of Oxford, which had such a devastating effect on his career that he had to settle for being one of the greatest poets in the history of the English language. Okay. Quebec. Yeah. Quebec is one of the most interesting places on earth for atheism. And this was a surprise to me. I think Quebec is a lovely place, but I don't particularly associate it with atheism. Here's what's interesting about Quebec. From the beginning, it has been the most religious province in Canada, because the French, when it was New France, the French required that you be a French Catholic in order to settle there. So all the way up until the middle of the 20th century, it was 83% Catholic and was the most religious province in Canada, really further than the middle of the 20th century, up into the 80s, I think you'd say that. Now, it is the least religious province in Canada, and still 83% Catholic. Exactly. Here's the deal. In Quebec, they're surrounded by English Protestants, right, in the country. And so they are very concerned about preserving their Frenchness. That's what that is the unique part of their identity, right? And Catholic goes with French, even more than fries goes with French in the United States. This is a big part of their identity. So they continue saying they're Catholic, but when a pollster asks the next question, do you believe in God? They say, oh, no. So they are cultural Catholics. And recently, Quebec actually changed its provincial school system from a Catholic school system to a secular one, and there was virtually not a peep about it. It passed with virtually no issues. So very interesting. They had the lowest regular church attendance in the provinces, around 10%, and the lowest percent who considered themselves religious at all, 22% who considered themselves theistically religious in an 83% Catholic. This is the reason that it's so hard to count people. Number four, kiss, kiss, build, build, help, help, bang, bang. This was I have a chapter on morality. in the book and talking about. I talk about, you know, all the things that have to be talked about, the, you know, oxytocin and serotonin and endorphins and, you know, evolutionary precursors of morality and mirror neurons and all these sorts of things. But one of the things that was really interesting that I found, if you're making an argument for atheist morality, what you're really doing is making an argument for human morality, right? You don't even have to make it about atheism. It's just that, you know, if humans are inclined toward moral behavior, that's the argument you have to make. So there's this one fascinating study I found in which researchers looked at the online war game called Pardis. You can't quite see that there, but that is a space warship bristling with missiles and weaponry. Pardis is an online, massively multiplayer online game in primarily in Europe. And the researchers, without telling them, they observed 400,000 players of this thing and looked at their actions in this game. Now, in this game, there are lots of things you can do, but everybody is traveling through a universe perpetually at war, and they're all in these bristling warships all the time, and there are essentially no rules. Now, that's a very interesting thing. But they can also form alliances with other people. They can build. They can cooperate. There are all sorts of things they can do. So the question is, what will they choose to do? And they tracked millions of behaviors of these players in this. And they found that 2% of the choices that were made, 2% of the things that players chose to do in a 3-month period were actually aggressive. 98% of the time, given an equal choice, they were choosing to do things that were in one way or another constructive. So I think that's the sort of thing that's a very kind of interesting, eye-opening question. If you're really given free rein, you are anonymously traveling through the universe in a warship and allowed to do pretty much whatever you want. And we choose more often than not to actually do something constructive. I like that. Number three, I learned that India, Australia, and Mexico have something in common. Anybody know what that is? They have all had openly atheist heads of state. Mexico had an openly atheist president in the 1920s, Plutarco Caius. I had no idea. I didn't even know when I began the project that Australia currently has an open atheist woman prime minister. Atheist woman, okay? Yeah. We suck, you know? That's the next thing that I get from that. It's like she's got the double going there, but that was an amazing thing. I knew about Nehru. That's a cool thing. First prime minister of India. Because think about it. When India first became independent, if they had chosen a Muslim president, or if they had chosen a prime minister, either one of those would have been tremendously divisive. So the atheist was actually the smart choice. Number two, I learned about the bluegrass blade. Tom Lawson isn't here, is he? Tom Lawson wrote this wonderful little book that is a compilation of, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, good, I'm almost there. Wrote this wonderful collection of letters to the editor of the Bluegrass Blade, which was the first free thought periodical in the United States. In Kentucky in the 1880s is when it was launched. And in 1903, the editor asked the readers to send in letters that said, "Why I'm an atheist." And you get this wonderful, wonderful collection. Charles Chilton Moore is the editor. This terrific collection of letters, not from philosophers and teachers and authors. This is farmers and doctors and homemakers and, you know, people from all walks of life. It is absolutely wonderful. It's available in the Library of Congress microfilm online. And Tom Lawson has created a book called Letters from an Atheist Nation, which I really recommend you look at to see this. Okay, and then my favorite one of all in this is the Fournier Register. This is a rare photo of Jacques Fournier, a 14th century bishop in the south of France, who was an inquisitor. His job was to ferret out Cathar heretics in the south of France. And I don't know if you're aware that the Inquisition was far more concerned with heretics than it was with atheists. They weren't looking for non-believers. They didn't, you know, first of all, they didn't really think there were any. But heretics are a much greater threat to orthodoxy. And so that's what they were after. But Fournier took a very interesting additional step of having every interrogation transcribed. So he had a scribe sitting there writing down everything that anybody said. I'm going to run a couple minutes into the question session, but these interrogations, most of them have not been translated into English. And one of the three of them that I was particularly interested in that I had found referred to were three atheists who were actually caught in the net, to his surprise, as he starts talking to them. I couldn't find it in English anywhere. They were in Latin and French, and one of them is locked up in the Vatican. I couldn't even get my hands on the original documents. And I finally found a graduate student team at the San Jose State University that had translated some of the Fournier transcripts. And I found the translator of these three because her name is Dareth Prey. Which is cool. The only Dareth Prey in the United States. And I tracked her down easily. It was Dareth Prey. And she completed the she had only done a partial thing. She completed the translations, and those are in the Voices of Unbelief book, and I also talk about them in the Dummies book as well. But they are stunning to read, these things. Here's one of the a little bit of one of the interrogations. The bishop says to this woman, Guillemette, who has been hauled before him, "From the moment that you believe that human souls die with the body," that's what she had apparently said to a friend of hers, "I just think the soul dies when the body dies. Did you believe that men would be resurrected or would live again after death? Or would live again after death?" And she said, "I did not believe in the resurrection of human bodies, for I believed that just as the body is buried, the soul is also buried with it. And as I saw the human body rot, I believed that you could never live again." Good for her, you know? And he said, "Did someone teach this to you? Did you learn it from someone?" And she said, "No, I thought it over and believed it by myself." Isn't that awesome? I absolutely love that. Then he said, "Do you now believe that Christ was resurrected?" And she said, "Yes, and I have believed it since the last holiday of the Ascension of the Lord, because at that time I heard tell that the bishop wanted to carry out an investigation against me." And I was afraid of the bishop because of that, and so I changed my opinion. I love that too. Yeah, no, I believe it now, all right? And then the last one, the most colorful of his interrogations, was this guy named Raymond Allaire, who witnesses described Raymond saying that God never made the world, that the resurrection was a myth, that the Eucharist was nothing more than bread and wine, that the rituals of the priests meant nothing, that he gave to the poor, not for his soul, but so that he would be thought a good man. And then at one point, he apparently told a friend, who then told the bishop, he said that Christ was created not through divine intervention, but, quote, "just like everyone else." And then he is described slamming the heel of his hand into his other hand to, you know, to describe this. I'd love to picture the bishop's face. So Jacques Fournier went on to become Pope Benedict XII after this. So anyway, there's the quick flight through 20 things I learned. I wanted to open it up to questions, last 10 minutes or so.
Upstairs?
Yeah.
So how did this book get started? Did you go to the Dummy series, or did they come to you?
They came first to Hemant Mehta, and he had his other book project going, he had other things going on, and he said, "You want to talk to Dale McGowan?" I am enormously grateful to Hemant for that. But it's also the nicest thing in the world to have publishers actually directly or indirectly seek you out instead of having to bust their doors down. Now, you had a process question, right?
Yeah, I did. I was in the process of writing a four dummy book. I'm pretty rigid of how you do that.
Well, it was very interesting because they know what they want and they know what works for the series. And so there was a 52-page author guide for this. Usually the author's guide is like 3 or 4 pages. 52 pages. There are certain words they want you to never use and certain other words they don't ever want you to use the word "we." And I mean never. It is weird because if you say, "we have since learned," you know, no, because that's looping you in with the reader and making an assumption that the reader agrees with you. So you never said, they're all the very well thought out stuff, really. And then sentence construction, they want it to be clear, but never talking down to the reader. They want it to be light. They love it when you poke fun at yourself and your own, you know, worldview, which I did much more successfully than the Catholics did, let me tell you. Yeah, because it's fun, and it's just, you know, it really puts people at ease, I think, which was part of the point of the thing. So it was an exhaustive and exhausting process. Chapter by chapter, I would send it to the editor, and he would look it over and send it back with notes on it and that sort of thing. It's really quite something, and incredibly enjoyable. Really, really fun. They really know what they're doing.
Any more questions there?
Yeah.
This may be more of a statement, but if the Catholic or Catholicism for Dummies was, you know, explicitly approved by the Vatican,
yeah.
I'm curious why there was a second edition.
Oh, that's very good. You know, I'll bet the answer would be that they updated the Pope's name or something like that, you know, when Benedict had. That's an excellent question.
You spoke about the anonymous survey of Congress and the number of atheists that will be off the record atheists. How many are on the record atheists?
At the moment, the answer to that is zero. The only one who's close is Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona, who sort of seemed to imply, you know, kind of went back and forth these sorts of things, and is now, you know, she's basically saying this is a personal thing, is the last that I heard. I respect that, frankly. This woman is representing a district in Arizona, and she's a Democrat and a progressive, and she is doing, you know, probably what she needs to do. My hope is that people won't need to do that for much longer. But to have her in that position right now, I have to respect her decisions to do what she has to do to keep, you know, where she is and to not second guess it.
A follow-up question on the, you said you had writing restrictions imposed upon you by the For Dummies people.
Yeah.
Did you find that helpful? Do you think it improved the book? Or
yeah.
Mostly.
They had virtually no content restrictions at all. This was not about content. It was about delivery. It was about style. That's what their thing is. They wanted it to be clear. They gave me tremendous liberty in building the chapters and deciding what topics I was going to do within atheism. They took my input on the cover. I mean, there's just an amazing amount of helpfulness with that. There are some times when their obsession with, like, keeping the word we out or avoiding passive voice is another thing. They never want to have passive voice. Well, sometimes passive voice is the best way to say something. Like, another construction they don't like is starting with it. You won't find any sentences in my book that start with it. You know, sometimes I wanted to say, it makes sense that, you know, and they wouldn't allow it. And instead they substituted this really horrible, you know, twisted up thing. Actually, there are a couple, because sometimes I said, I'm starting with it. This sentence needs to start with it. But for the most part, it was quite helpful. They were really very good and professional.
Were you able to find the research material online, or did you have to travel to libraries or send letters and get paper copies back?
It was a mix. Thanks to Google, we take Google for granted at this point, but I remember when it was extremely difficult to get a hold of things. Google's original, I mean, their stated mission or whatever is to organize all human knowledge, right? I mean, that's what their intention is. They have, through the scanning processes, through the Library of Congress, that's another one that has scanned a tremendous amount of periodicals from the past and books. I was able to find most things online. Other things, I traveled to a couple of universities in Georgia to get some copies. The material on the Islamic Golden Age was not easy to find online. There was this translator who helped me with the Inquisition transcripts. But most of it was available for everybody, which is fabulous. It's wonderful.
You said 28 members of Congress.
Right.
I'm scared to ask, that's upper and lower house together, I assume?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
oh, I'm sure it is, yeah. And so that's the number of people who are willing to say, even in a secret, you know.
One out of 20.
Survey, yeah, exactly. Which, you know, it's, getting better. is the way I look at it. I'm amazed that, because I immediately assume there are twice as many in reality.
When I looked at the title of the book, I actually thought it would be talking a little bit more about misconceptions about atheism and atheism in real life.
Yeah.
More statements.
Right. It does. Yeah, the whole first part, there are five parts, and the whole first part is devoted to that. But today, I didn't want to go over the things, I didn't have to tell you why you're not Satanists. Yeah, so yes, that's the whole first fifth of the book is devoted to that. And then there's a section on the history, there's a section on great works, there's a section on basically being an everyday atheist. What's it like for people, you know, that sort of thing. And then there's a thing called the part of tens, which they always have, which is basically lists of 10 things, you know, in the back. 10 people who are non-believers who you probably didn't know were non-believers, that sort of thing. But yes, it starts out with those misconceptions and all that sort of thing.
So with a lot of the atheist literature that comes out, there's always a fallback, a fallout. There's always someone who feels the need to respond or respond negatively.
Yeah.
For a book like this, with it being part of the Four Dummies series, have you gotten any of that?
It's been out for 4 days.
Oh, there we go.
So I will. This is a much higher profile thing than my parenting books, for example. It's interesting. Like with the parenting books, even then, I mean, it was covered in Newsweek, and you would think that I would have gotten a lot of blowback then. It's amazing that how you position yourself isn't going to stop everybody, but it actually helps to deflect a certain amount of that kind of stuff. I don't want to waste a whole lot of time with that. The purpose of this thing was to be very fun and light, and hopefully that's the way it will be read. Most of the people I imagine who have a lot of difficulty with it won't have read it. That's my guess.
I'm nervous when people in America, black person, watch. Do you think American people are ready for a non-religious president?
Oh, ready for a non-religious president?
Yeah.
Well, you know, an out non-religious president, you mean? Because I think we've actually had at least one already. No, we're not culturally ready for that. But I can now envision the time when we will be. Attitudes are changing incredibly rapidly. Really, really, attitudes and numbers. You know, the idea of the coexist bumper stickers and that sort of thing is not the sort of thing that you would have seen during the moral majority in the 1980s. There are a lot of people who are both religious and perfectly fine with other people not being. But I don't think we're anywhere near the critical mass that would be necessary for somebody to actually throw that over.
All right, let's go one more question. I saw my hand somewhere here.
Are you doing a book tour?
No, they actually don't. That's not common anymore. People like J.K. Rowling or Stephen King or something like that will do a book tour, but below the 99.999% of the rest of us, it's not useful. It's not economically feasible anymore because the internet is a much better way to get the word out. So I, you know, when I come to events like this, we have the books, but not a specific tour.
All right, let's give it up for Dylan McGowan.
Okay. Thank you.